Oscars.
Welcome to No Prize from God, episode 13. No Prize from God features conversations with creative people about belief, unbelief, and everything between. I'm your host, Ryan J. Downing. Our guest this episode is Chad Johnson, former A&R executive for Tooth & Nail Records, and author of the brand new book, 1,000 Risks. In the late 1990s, Chad Johnson transformed his mail order record distro into the DIY label Take Hold Records, based out of his bedroom in Birmingham, Alabama. Take Hold Records number 8 was Active Depression, the 1999 debut album from a group of Florida kids calling themselves Under Oath. Take Hold was also home to Through the Eyes of Caitlin, a side project of Zayo co-founder Jesse Smith, which is actually how I first came to know of Chad and got in contact with him back then, and a split EP featuring Further Seems Forever with a young Chris Caraba on vocals. Like most labels of the era and scene, Take Hold was driven by passion first and commerce second. In fact, by the time Tooth & Nail Records took notice of the Christian-leaning bands Chad had quietly helped to develop, Take Hold was deeply in debt. In 2002, Chad sold the label to Tooth & Nail and accepted an A&R position with them in Seattle, where he continued to work with Under Oath as the band grew to release important records, two of which were certified gold. And at Tooth & Nail, Chad was instrumental in discovering and signing bands like Anne Berlin, Haste the Day, As Cities Burn, Beloved, He Is Legend, and he worked as A&R with Further Seems Forever, Me Without You, and more. Then at the start of 2009, Chad abruptly left the traditional music business, quitting his job at Tooth & Nail to launch a self-described missionary music venture with a pay-what-you-want or pay-nothing-at-all model. And again, this was 2009. 100% of proceeds were to go to humanitarian and mission organizations, and all physical CDs and LPs would be packaged with recycled material. Come and Live staffers, including Chad, who has a wife and two kids, pledged to rely solely on personal fundraising to support themselves, putting a radical faith in Jesus Christ to provide their earthly needs in this new pursuit. In the nearly 10 years since, Come and Live has grown and transformed in various ways. Chad has traveled to different parts of the world, and the heart of their mission remains steadfast. As I mentioned, Chad has just released his first book, 1,000 Risks, Fighting Fear for an Awkward, Awesome Life with Jesus. Now, wherever you land on the faith spectrum, Chad is a fascinating guy, someone who will approach strangers and pray for them in a way that's anything but Ned Flanders. He's somewhere between hippie troubadour, ambitious faith healer, and dad joke-making grown-up hardcore kid. Chad is a person who bubbles over with genuine joy, intertwined with confessional insecurities, which lends an authenticity to the work that he does. He's not so enamored with the specifics of complicated theology, and he certainly avoids polarizing politics, in my experience. I've never heard him breathe a word of fire and brimstone. He's not old-fashioned in the tent revival sense. He's old-school in the New Testament sense, approaching every interaction with wide-eyed wonder and purposeful positivity. I was both flattered and honored when Chad asked me to write something for his book, and this is what I gave him. Even for the more skeptical and, let's face it, cynical among us, it's impossible not to feel inspired around Chad Johnson. His faith is something palpable in the air surrounding him, an almost tangible electricity that supercharges everyone he meets, from prominent rock stars to the families living in dire poverty around the world. Chad isn't wearing a costume of piousness. He's as real and relatable as they come, which makes his persistent joy and insistence on the gospel all the more powerful in real-life terms. 1,000 Risks is a book about forsaking the world in pursuit of saving the world, one person at a time, with the absolute trust of a child in the guidance and faithfulness of our Creator. So here it is, my conversation with my old friend Chad Johnson. This is No Prize from God.
You think that when you are dead, you stay in your grave? Well, I'm in
So let's start at the very beginning and actually learn, I'm sure, a few things that I don't know about you.
Wow, that's kind of hard to believe,
I
but
know,
okay.
right? Tell me a bit about your parents and your childhood
Wow.
and growing up and what you were like as a kid and what sort of within the context of
Yeah.
faith and life's bigger questions and when and where all
Sure.
that entered in for you.
Well, have you been on my Facebook page recently?
Yes, sir.
You have?
I have.
Oh yeah, that's what I was gonna say. So you are more prophetic than what I think you know. But the reason I say that is because I had an incredible upbringing, and I grew up born in Chicago, lived there for a few years until my parents became full-blown missionaries to no other place, Ryan Downey, than the Caribbean. Somebody has to serve Jesus in the Caribbean, and my parents signed up. I was not disappointed to leave snow for the Caribbean. But when I was 13, my dad got me my PADI certification, so I began the process of scuba diving. We would do like night dives, shark dives, shipwreck dives.
Wow.
Literally, at one point, caught a lobster nearly with our bare hands, and then brought it home. Huge spiny lobster at like 60 feet underwater. Brought it home, cooked it boiled it that night, had some butter and garlic, and as fresh of a lobster as you could possibly hope for. So yeah, I grew up living overseas for I guess about 15 years of
Wow.
my childhood life. And the reason I say you're prophetic is that if you visited my Facebook profile, you would probably see quite a bit of people talking about my dad. So my dad is in the fi very final stages of congestive heart failure. So he is in a hospice center awaiting the resurrection of the final death of his temporary body for resurrection and permanent time with Jesus. So yeah, man. So it's super challenging in the sense that our whole family is dealing with the loss before the loss. It's like
Yeah.
the pre, it's so weird because right now I'm working on a book, and so I'm doing, as I'm doing these pre-orders. And so there's so many weird, eerie similarities between the birth of a book project and the dying of my dad that it's like,
Yeah.
man, what is happening? But there's a right now I feel like our whole family's kind of in this pre-mourning, pre-loss, maybe not pre-mourning because we're already mourning, but I think just the struggle there, and realizing that life is temporary, regardless of how old you are, or who you are, or what you believe. And but yeah, man, my upbringing was amazing. I have three siblings. Ironically, all of us follow Jesus very radically and do a variety of different Jesus or quote unquote kingdom activities, to steal a Sleeping Giant line or song title,
I've heard of those guys.
But it's really, yeah, it's been really kind of God to give us a to give me a family that's just been really committed and super. One of the things that my dad has been doing is someone's actually been reading him my book, and so
Oh,
there's
wow.
this really crazy, like, for him, one of his final goals is to read my book. And so there's just a weird, heavy, yet beautiful kind of connection between. I've never been super super tight with my dad. That's not to say that we've had a bad relationship or any of that. It's just that it's not. I'm so independent that my independence has caused me to rarely see my father as someone that I need in life. And so, of course, when you're about to lose someone, you begin to see them very differently than how
Yeah.
you have. But yeah, man, that's kind of the longer than you probably anticipated
No, not at all.
story
And
of my
and
childhood
when
and
you asked if
whatever.
I'd been to your Facebook page recently, I just thought, yeah, I see you on Facebook. But no, I wasn't aware of
Right.
the situation at all. So no, you're right. That was interesting serendipity that that's right where I
Yeah,
wanted to
yeah. No,
start.
that's good. That's a good start. Yeah, that's a good starting point, and that's very appropriate to the season that I'm living in right now.
Yeah, endings and beginnings all wrapped up
Yeah.
in alpha and omega in your own
Right.
life right now.
Yeah, exactly.
Did you have, I'm always curious with my friends who came from a strong faith background in whatever tradition. Did you Was there ever a moment of sort of, I mean, of course, you know, there's always questioning and doubt, and that's part of faith. But was there ever a moment where you felt that you kind of commanded a faith of your own, so to speak, that you at some point did it transform from the what you'd been brought up with from your parents and relatives and people around you? Do you remember any kind of turning point where it became yours, where you went, okay, this is this isn't just what I was taught, this is what I have for myself?
It's kind of, as soon as you said commanding your faith, I had the picture of the movie Master and Commander and just the Spaniards on this huge old like massive sailboat.
Yeah.
And just, you know, my parents like just rocking it somewhere in the Pacific on this crazy boat. And then finally I realized, man, I really want my own Spanish Jesus sailboat. So I'm going now I'm commanding my own faith, but I actually like how you put that. At some point, every kid who grows up within Christian faith recognizes, or within any faith, recognizes hypocrisy. And it's really easy to be the pointer of many fingers at others, you know, rather than to recognize your own hypocrisy. And so that was me. I was really good at pointing my fingers at all of the issues that I saw around me. I had, until I was about 18, I had zero interest in Christian faith. And I had a lot of interest in other faiths and exploring them. But I was living in South America, and I was nearly arrested and placed in prison 10 years, no questions asked, for the distribution of narcotics. And so I definitely had one of my very own personalized come to Jesus moment. How's that for an ad that we didn't expect was coming?
Yeah.
it was crazy, because my good friend back then, I remember asking her like, hey, my life sucks and it's looking really miserable. And I've got to figure something out, because this is not good. I mean, at one point during lunch, right after my friends and I had put away our drugs and like just stuffed everything away, three military police came walking into this park where we were all seated with M16s and asked for all of our paperwork. So we're high as kites. And I think that even in that moment, I thought that was funny, you know, and I didn't realize until I visited four prisons in Ecuador, South America, that I realized just how ludicrous and how dangerous the whole situation was. So I remember my friend telling me, you need Jesus. And I was broken enough, and I was frustrated enough, and I was curious enough to get down on my knees and just do, you know, kind of like pray the stereotypical Jesus, if you're real, I don't really believe in you, but my friend says that you're real and I have a crush on her, so therefore I guess I'll at least try this, you know.
Yeah.
And I did that, and nothing changed. I kind of expected in that moment to have angels come in and start singing in the room, or mm-hmm. or like at least double rainbows to appear or something crazy, but none of that happened. And yet over time, progressively, my heart just began to soften toward God, toward Jesus, toward the Holy Spirit. And so now, 21 years later, that girl has been my wife for 21 years. It's actually been longer than 21 years since that night. But it's crazy how the humor of God works in my life, because some of the most significant people and moments have carried through, even though I never would have foreseen that. So,
which is also an interesting, a very kind of profound sequence of events when you look at the overall narrative of your life. If you were going to script it into, you know, a movie and say like there's certain acts, right?
Right.
And here you have this very significant first act where Beth, your wife, your future wife, brings you to Jesus, essentially.
Yeah.
And then, you know, in the next chapter, you're bringing her out of the comfort and security of modern suburban life and professional world of the music industry, and saying, "Hey, I feel like we need to throw everything away and depend on God to pay our mortgage and feed our family."
That's when she was thinking she probably should not have led me to Jesus.
you're going to pull me over here? Now watch where I'm going to pull you.
Right.
Yeah. You started this.
I see how this goes.
Yeah. Incredible. But before we get there, I want to talk about, going from that sort of transformative moment then in Ecuador to around the time that you and I would have become acquainted, which was when you were doing Take Hold Records and when, Furnace Fest and all that sort of stuff was happening. What was your introduction into kind of the Christian music world and, and how that developed into founding a label and putting out records?
Yeah, I mean, I could get really history nerdy here, but for the sake of time and everyone who doesn't care to hear all that, I'll start with the tooth and nail side, because that is obviously the most relevant and sort of applicable part of the story. But I had always been a fan of music, and in high school, a youth pastor told me there were bands that sounded like Metallica. And then he introduced me to like Bride and White Cross and all these really funny, interesting bands that didn't, Deliverance, Vengeance Rising, that didn't really sound a whole lot like Metallica at all. But still, I could see, kind of where he was coming from. And so I just began discovering Christian music. And I remember going into a family Christian bookstore in what I guess would have been 1993, maybe 94. And I saw an album with this like spiky haired cartoony figure on it. And it said Magnified Plaid, Poking at Ya Punk, or I think that was the name of their first record. And I thought it was a hip hop record, which back then I had zero interest in hip hop. And so I mistook the cover, but I really liked pop punk. And so had I known what it was, I would have been all about it. But I also discovered Starflyer 59 Silver record at that same bookstore. And so I realized there was a correlation in flipping these CD I think they were CD cases. They could have been cassettes, but no, they were CD cases. I mean, this is 1994, dude. We're really cruising.
Yeah. Maybe long boxes, or I guess we were just out of long boxes. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. This was way before vinyl was cool. Although, Tooth and Nail, Starflyer, I did have a early Starflyer 7-inch and a couple of MXPX 7-inches that were incredible. But man, that just kind of, that I think Tooth and Nail opened my eyes to the fact that you could be Christian and still really creatively intriguing and good and exciting. And so it probably spurred on this, like, well, maybe there are bands that are Christian that aren't Metallica, but that are actually really, really good for what they're doing and in their own right. And so I think it kind of gave me a newfound appreciation. And so, yeah, out of that, I just started selling a couple of random CDs by a record label called Boot to Head Records. And they had a artist.
Sounds like a skinhead label.
Yeah, yeah, I know.
Boot to the head, like they were putting out Oi and ska.
Right, right. Blaster the Rocket Man, I think, was one of their bands. And so anyway, I started selling.
Yeah, I saw some of their Burn It Down played with that band once.
Yeah, so there you go. Yeah. I would go to old, like back when Strong Arm played with Zao on Zao's very first Splinter Shards, The Birth of Separation. I don't even remember the title. It was really, really long, but
that record.
Yeah. Right? at that show and many others, Stave Saker, all kinds of MXP, all kinds of bands, I would show up and I'd set up this little tiny booth. And then that kind of morphed into a record store called Slacker 66 that eventually turned into a really, really shady, small, sweaty, nasty music venue. But we did have some incredible shows. So a friend of mine just reminded me before this call with you that we had Zao, Training for Utopia, Stretch Armstrong, and Spitfire all in this thing. We had Jimmy Eat World on their Clarity album, to the point where... Wow. I remember Jimmy Eat World coming into my office, setting up their laptops, and I thought, these guys are gods. They have made it because they've got laptops. These things are incredible. Nobody had laptops back then. You know, you were rich. If you had a desktop, you were rolling. Yeah. So they gave me a limited edition blue Clarity vinyl, and I just remember thinking this is crazy, but it was Jimmy Eat World Clarity Tour at the drive-in supporting with 238 as the opener. And so just, you know, Living Sacrifice ended up closing the venue down because so many kids came, and I was gone that night, and a kid fainted, and so they called 911. 911 called the fire marshal. The fire marshal came out, shut us down. But that was you know, right around the time that I began discovering bands. I realized that there were all these bands that Tooth & Nail and other labels weren't signing that got me really excited, like little bands like Under Oath and 238 and Few Left Standing and all these different Narcissists, all these different bands that that I thought were really great, but no one seemed to care. And so I just wanted to help them, even though I was clueless. I studied psychology. I have no rhythm. I cannot sing. I can't play a single instrument. I'm the least likely music person on the planet. And yet here we are. So,
I mean, and that's, you know, you found a way to contribute to something that was so vital and important to you in a way that wasn't, you know, you're like, okay, if I'm not going to produce records or perform or get on stage, what else can I do? You know, and I think there's something to be said for that, obviously. Getting that music out and getting records in the hands of people. It's funny, when you were talking about the laptop thing, it reminded me of the first time that I was ever around Wi-Fi, which was probably around 2002. Yep. I was hanging out with a couple screenwriters I'd become friends with here in LA. I just hadn't lived here that long. And I remember being at their house, and they were all on their laptops, and they were all on the internet, and none of them were plugged into anything. Wow. And I literally,
I remember, like, what is happening? Okay,
they were showing me Wi-Fi and Segways at the same time. They were watching videos of people riding Segways, and I thought the whole thing was an elaborate joke. I literally thought they were just making fun of me. Like, there was no way they were on the internet without being plugged in. And there was no way these videos they were showing me of people riding around Segways were a real thing, that those were like the whole thing. I was just like, I just felt like such a hayseed from Indiana in that moment of like, here I am in this like Hollywood house with these like LA people, and they're doing this like elaborate practical joke. And then it was like, no, this is it was all real, actually.
Wow. Dude, that's crazy. Yeah, that is it's funny to think that once upon a time, even the idea of email was so novel that it was like, wait, you actually got a message from me? This is crazy.
Yeah.
So it's,
I used to go to the computer lab at the local college where I didn't attend with friends at, you know, 1 a.m. because it was 24 hours.
And yeah.
That's where we would explore the World Wide Web. Yeah, the first time.
That's right, man.
Yeah.
Think of how wealthy we would be if we went back in time and knew what we know now about the internet. I mean, DonaldTrump.com, you know, or I don't know what, whatever domain we wanted to buy. We would have been rolling.
Totally. I was going to ask, you know, quickly, if you could just kind of run me through then that transition between, Take Hold, you know, being acquired by Tooth & Nail and that sort of creating a job for you there, and you moving your life and everything from the South up to Seattle. Yeah. If you just kind of quickly run me through that, because then there's a bunch of other stuff I want to get into that.
Okay.
More fun.
Yeah. I mean, I was in about 120 grand of debt, credit card debt, mostly one bank loan to Take Hold. And at that point I had basically, typically in my life, I've had two recurring passions that oftentimes run very parallel to each other, music and Jesus. But there are times when either of those fizzle out. So in this was a season where music was going strong, Jesus not so much. And so I had kind of lost faith in God, and I was really just doing my own thing. And I told Beth, my wife, that I thought we should just file for bankruptcy and be done with the whole thing. And she said, no, I totally refuse. We're never going to file for bankruptcy. You know, she was really committed to this idea of not filing for bankruptcy. And so she started praying, and literally within about a week was when I had begun receiving an email from Brandon Ebel that was tied into the band Few Left Standing. And he wanted to distribute their new album Wormwood. And I said, man, that's awesome of you, but I really need help with all of my titles and the whole thing. So what have you helped me with the whole thing? And then he responded with a typical, you know, his classy, as you well know, one-liners. How much do you want for your company? There's no like, you know, hi, have a great day, or, or you know, nothing. Literally just how much do you want for your company? And I thought, who is this guy? So, so anyway, I threw that, ended up over about, I guess, a 6 month time period, ended up flying up to Seattle, meeting with Brandon, meeting with Jim, meeting some of the people there, working out a deal, which essentially was to pay off my debt and license a bunch of the catalog to them and start over. And so, yeah, man, it was that was a very crazy answer to my wife's praying, and a very huge surprise to me, because I once really viewed Tooth and Nail as the enemy of the work I was doing at Takehold. I thought we were the self-righteous, you know, holier than Tooth and Nail Christian label. And of course, you know, all that's horrible to say now, and so stupid, and no wonder, you know, we had to be bought out by Brandon for Jesus to get a plank out of my eye. Oh, dude, I don't know. Did you even catch that one?
I like it.
I did not even mean that.
I like it. So, plank eye.
Anyway.
Oh, my goodness. That was like a triple entendre. I liked it. Yeah, and I think that's something that, you know, even people who don't know anything about the Christian music industry or the Christian music scene can probably relate to in the punk rock world, you know, that idea of like, you know, Tooth and Nail had a major label affiliation at one point, but also started as an independent label, but it's certainly grown in size to become sort of the dominant force in that subculture. And then you always have the rabble rousing bedroom labels with the scrappier of the bands that the big label doesn't know about yet and whatever. That's kind of that contrarian upstart that views what came before as the, you know, we're the iconoclast and we got to tear that down and pick apart. And then, it's interesting is that, you know, just as Brandon goes from starting Tooth and Nail in his bedroom, you know, next thing you know, you turn around and you're the guy who started Takehold, and all of a sudden you're in Seattle, a record label executive, you know, dealing with contracts with EMI and all this stuff. You know, it's like how that whole process sort of, you know, it's like a blink of a plank eye.
It's true.
And then
blink of a plank eye.
There you are. You're doing it too. the thing that I wanted to, and obviously I'm going to tell people that they need to read your book, and a lot of this stuff is covered in your book. One of the things I wanted to get into with you a little bit is before you made the decision to leave the music industry and, you know, everything that led to Come and Live and everything that you've been doing for the last several years, I want to talk a little bit about, you know, unlike a lot of the position that we all know is A&R in the music industry, you were an A&R person, mm-hmm. Found mm-hmm. talent and developed them and shepherded them in terms of their career and were their point of contact at the record label and helped them navigate, you know, dealing with all the other moving parts of the label. And that's what every A&R person does, essentially. But I want to talk about sort of that pastoral role that you had also that was tied into the faith-driven element that's incorporated within Tooth and Nail somewhere, and with the continuity with a lot of the bands that had Christian members, whether they were Christian bands or whatever. You were a person that, you know, if bands were having a hard time on the road, if there was trouble in a marriage, if there were drugs being abused, if there were questions happening with faith or, you know, inner band drama, you were kind of the guy, right, that the label would send and go like, let's fly Chad out to Warped Tour to hang out with these guys and help navigate these issues, or let's and I'm really sort of curious, you know, now with the perspective of hindsight and the years that have come since, you know, because this I think was really sort of a behind the scenes thing and it was uncomfortable to talk about then, but I'm curious now what sort of light you can shed on that role and obviously the struggles.
Yeah,
that comes along with that, you know.
Sure.
It to me is a very unique feature that's specific to that time and place in music. specific right. to Christian music,
specific
to you as an individual, as to the bands of that day, and something that I think a lot of people don't know about or understand. But, you know, somewhere in there, it's like, well, the label's not a ministry, but it is, but it isn't. And I'm not this band's pastor. I'm their A&R guy, but I'm also sort of their pastor. And just really curious to hear from you to kind of explain to people what that was all about.
Yeah, I mean, I actually think the role of A&R sets you up better than any other role. Maybe management being the only other role that I can think of that would set you up even better for serving artists or individual creatives in a way that is that where you are a peacemaker and you are you are a person that they are developing trust with, because if they can't trust you, then the odds that they are going to sign their careers to your record label go down dramatically. So I do think there was a part of me when I turned 30, so 14 years ago, I had an encounter with God where I realized that I had been wasting time and wasting my life. And it was in Seattle. It was on the viaduct. I felt like God, in a still small kind of way, asked me why I was fighting him. And in that moment, I broke down. I very distinctly remember crying my eyes out, weeping, which I very rarely do. But especially in the context of an 8 a.m. commute downtown Seattle on the way to Tooth and Nail, I was not expecting that. And so the Lord definitely did something in my heart at that point where I just began to see the artist more for their spiritual potential than for their career, business, strategic potential. And I, you know, just obviously I didn't do it all right. And it took me listening to the Under Oath podcast, on the Tooth and Nail labeled podcast where, Toby and Matt and those guys, Aaron, interview Under Oath, and Spencer Chamberlain, singer of Under Oath, said on there that, well, Chad was the one that like blew my cocaine cover at Warped Tour to the rest of the band. And I, at this point, have zero recollection, and that's not me trying to make myself look prettier than am. I just don't recall, but I'm sure he's right. He has no reason to throw me under the bus other than that was what happened. And so I think that's a perfect example of who I wasn't really called to be. Who I was called to be was Spencer's friend, Spencer's brother, the confidant that Spencer and others could come to and say, hey man, I'm dealing with cocaine, or I'm dealing with girls, or with drugs, or with alcohol. Cocaine, I guess, technically is a drug, but with alcohol or whatever it is. And they knew that I was someone that they could trust. And so it was actually really heartbreaking when I listened to that podcast and I just realized, you know, man, like that's horrible. So I guess when you say it, when you look back, that I'm super thankful for what God did. And I do believe he used me in very special and very powerful ways to serve artists as more than just their business liaison. But I also realized that, man, I would have done things very differently had I to do it all over again. And so anyway, I think, you know, it's like all of us, we learn, we grow, we thankfully are not who we were 10 years ago. And there's good reason for that. So,
yeah. And I would imagine that in the 14 years of experience that you've accumulated in ministry and through doing Come and Live and this sort of radical transformation that you underwent as a person and as a believer and so on, that guidance and that advice and that relationship that you were able to offer to bands back then would be even so much more if you had the opportunity to confront some of those crises at the same time. I don't think that you should beat yourself up that you did a bad job at it then. I feel like
I think you're right too.
Right. But I think that, of course it would always,
I was learning, I was growing, right. I was discovering Jesus all over again. And this time I just happened to be in a position of authority with artists who were themselves in positions of authority, you know, and their platforms were growing massively and so quickly that it was just a rush, like a roller coaster rush for everybody. And so to stop and say, hey, Aaron Gillespie, how can I pray for you? Hey, Aaron Lunsford, how can I pray for you? Hey, Ryan Downey, how can I pray for you? You know, it's like there was a part of me that I think was beginning to realize that there was more to life than the rock and roll stardom that we were experiencing, and just wanting to tap into a deeper place, you know, with myself, with God, with my friends and the people I was working with. But yeah, man, I would have exited very differently had I to do it all over again. But you're also right.
Would you say that you would reinvent your exit?
Yeah, dude, I would actually be the guy jumping off the building, the rooftop.
We're just bumming out so many people with our dad jokes.
This is what happens, man, when
two 1973ers get together.
Yep. Oh, that's true. Wow, you're 1973 too. Dude. That's crazy.
They call it the baby bust. I found that out a few years ago that there's a reason why everyone we've ever known seems to be a year or two older than us or a year or two younger. Nobody's ever our exact age. And it's the baby bust. There was the baby boom, and 73 was the baby bust. It was a year where there were fewer babies.
Wow.
Here we are.
Interesting. Yeah. Thanks for teaching me something new.
You're welcome. I just had this conversation with Rose McGowan, actually, who's a fellow 73er.
Cool.
So this opens up exactly what you're talking about in this pivotal moment for you. It opens up something that I'm most excited to get into with you as a friend and a fellow believer and seeker and everything. This podcast, you know, has had a very wide section of creative people with diverse experiences in faith or lack thereof.
Mm-hmm.
So opening up this portion of the conversation to both people who are Christians from various faith standpoints, to people who are atheists, to people who are wherever they are on the spectrum, you know, are a multitude of different faith practices.
Yep.
You are so charismatic, so passionate, so on fire for your faith, but you are the guy that, I mean, the most recent time that we got to hang out, we had breakfast together, and you know, you're the guy that starts asking our waitress not only how can I pray for you in these things that could be considered evangelism, but also just like, how are you, who are you, what's going on in your life, what you know, are you married, oh, how's your husband, oh, how many kids do you have, how, oh, they're grown, and what, oh, your grandmother, what. And I find that is not only so endearing and encouraging about you, but it's also terrifying, because I'm the kind of person, you know, I mean, I interview people for a living, right? And it's something that I've made a career out of and so on. And I've gotten on stage as a guy in a band and as a presenter or whatever, you know, and spoken to people. But those one-on-one interactions with strangers that you push yourself into all day long, that terrifies me. I mean, it just, I you know, and I think it terrifies most people, you know, and I think
I think you're right.
A unique gift that you have, and I think it terrifies you, and I think that's kind of what's exciting is how you keep pushing yourself through it. So, that's just as a topic of conversation, something I'm
sure
wildly excited
just,
to get into.
I mean,
into.
I think the first thing I would say is, right, especially, if, you know, if I can pause briefly to the point that you started with, which was, hey, there, Chad, there are a lot of different people listening to this.
Yes.
Some of them will think you're great because they totally agree with you and your Jesus stance. Some of them will think you're an idiot because they totally disagree. And I think I would just like to start out by publicly saying, I, as a follower of Jesus, apologize to anyone who has been burned by people like me or even me, and who have, whether it was a church, whether it was an individual, whether it was a politician, I don't know who I could be talking about there.
2 Corinthians? I'm sorry.
Right. whoever it was, I just want to apologize for how misrepresentative I can be, and unfortunately many of us followers of Jesus can be. And so I just feel like starting the conversation on spirituality from a place of, I feel if I can put myself low, you know, if I can bring myself down and humble myself and just admit that I don't have all the answers, that I don't have it all figured out perfectly, and my little faith synopsis is still a work in progress and not this little birthday Christmas present with a bow all perfectly, you know, put together. That to me I think is a much more genuine starting point than anything else. So what I love most about what you just said is that, Chad, what you do seems terrifying to me, but I also think it's terrifying to you. And that's, you nailed it. Like what most people think is that I am not terrified every time I approach a stranger and say, hey, how, I mean, I'm not, I take it back. I'm not terrified to ask my waiter, how are you doing? You know, like, hey, what's your name, waiter? Yeah. That's not hard. That it's, but it is terrifying when I begin to feel like the Holy Spirit of God is placing ideas on my heart for that waiter or for whoever the quote unquote stranger is, where I could be totally wrong. And I am often wrong, where I'll be like, hey, do you have anything going on with your right ankle, like specifically from a football accident? And they'll just look at me like, dude, I weigh 350 pounds and I've never played sports a day in my life. And like, no, I don't have anything wrong with my ankle. And so, I think it's just realizing that fear was never who a single Christian was called to be. And Christians of all people were meant to be the most loving, most selfless, other-serving kind of people. And I've just wanted to enter more into that story, you know, and like, how do I admit that I suck at it, admit that I'm afraid, and ask if God is real, ask him to give me strength to move past myself. And so that's where I found myself and the reason why I wrote a book, because God gave me strength to take 1,000 different risks and document them, the good and the bad, the highs and the lows, the miracles of crazy proportions, the really, really awkward moments of equally crazy proportions, you know, where I'm praying for somebody that doesn't have an arm and I'm saying, arm, I command you to grow back right now in Jesus' name. And I'm saying this prayer while simultaneously knowing I'm insane, you know, like, but also having this like eager expectation that why not, dude? Why would I not pray the most elaborately huge, colossal prayers to the King of the universe if I actually believe he is who he says he is? So, I still haven't seen an arm grow back from nothing or a leg grow back from nothing. And, but if that day ever does come, then one, I'm going to faint instantly. And because I won't know how to handle the reality of that kind of a crazy thing happening. And then two, it probably will not be anywhere near as crazy as I thought, because there's just been a lot of little steps leading up to it. And it's like, oh, I fainted and now I woke up and like, oh yeah, dude, your arm's back. Like that is insane, but it also isn't that crazy. And on that front, on the risk level, I was at a Walmart one time and I was with a group of people that I was training on how to, not really training, but just mentoring, maybe encouraging them with how they could take more risks. And so I said, you know, so you guys follow me around and I'll just show you what I do. And which is always awkward. It's awkward. I'm awkward enough just on my own, let alone with five other people who are also awkward. And we're all kind of like, let's walk around Walmart and pretend like we really want to be here. But I walked up to this guy with a cane and I said, hey, what's going on with your leg? I said, hey, can I pray for you? And he said, sure. And I said, is it your leg? You know, he had a cane. Yep, it's my leg. And he pulled up his pant leg to reveal his prosthetic limb. And without, you know, what I should have done was, hey man, I've honestly never seen God grow back a limb. And if he does, I'm going to freak out, but may I still pray a prayer so extreme over you? And then is there anything, you know, that maybe like, hey, how's your family? You know, can I pray for your family or anything else? Yeah. That's maybe not quite as crazy. But instead I peaced out with the whole gang with me. I was like, okay, I didn't even know what to say. I just left and I didn't say anything. So there's some guy at Walmart still waiting, wondering where Chad went.
He's like, what are you going to do about my leg here? Yeah.
Yeah. Waiting for his miracle that I was meant to deliver.
now you raise an interesting point. You know, in so much as you've prayed over people and asked for things that you haven't seen delivered. And of course that begs the question, have you seen things delivered in those situations, yeah, you know?
That's a great begging question. No, it's a great question. I think it's probably the most important question for any of us, even those of us who are not skeptical cynics, which I ironically am both skeptical and a cynic. And I just feel like God, neither of those two positions are hard for Jesus to deal with. So routinely for 2,000 years, he's been dealing with skeptical cynics. So
I mean,
I think that question is great.
all throughout the Gospels, Jesus Christ is a skeptic.
Right. And
He's
people
walking around
are.
questioning everything around him constantly. That was his whole mission.
So, yeah, man, I have seen, my eyes have seen Jesus perform wonders that make absolutely no physical, earthly, realistic sense. You know, like when a boy is born blind in his right eye, and his mom and his uncle are called into the church from their homes. They don't even know their son's at a church in the first place, in the middle of nowhere, Colombia. And this boy begins seeing, and his mom and uncle come an hour later and confirm this and are weeping over it. When I'm at a park in Birmingham, Alabama, and a woman with a blind walking stick and the blind glasses is on, gets totally healed to the point of not needing her blind walking stick. I have seen more miracles, supernatural miracles of demonic deliverances, of physical healing, of people having crazy prophetic revelations from God that I or others with me never could have guessed about them. I've seen more of that in the past, I don't know, I guess 40 or something years, or sorry, not in the last 40. I was born seeing miracles. It's weird. Sorry, that is not what I meant. In the past few years, more than ever in the 40 something years prior. And so there's a part of me that realizes that at the end of the day, all of us, especially in a wealthy Western culture, have placed ourselves up on pretty high pedestals of what we think is possible. And oftentimes, when you get down off of that high horse and you actually enter into poverty, either places where extreme poverty is the norm, or where extreme simplicity of life is the norm, it's all of a sudden not, people don't seem nearly as shocked that they just got healed of a brain tumor disappearing, or of a cancer leaving them, or of some crazy thing. So yeah, man. So I don't know. Somebody asked me that the other day, like, does prayer actually work? And I told my response was, that's basically why I wrote the book, because I'm convinced prayer works, even if I don't always see it work the way I want to. I've seen more prayers answered in the last couple of years than ever in my life, and some of them are on such an extreme level that I myself am just like crying. Like I routinely will see someone healed, and the only thing I can do is weep, because it's like, this is so retarded. Like, I cannot do this. I don't have the ability to do this. And so I just think that I think God actually really appreciates people who are skeptics and cynics, and welcomes that. And I don't think that Jesus, when Jesus was alive, I think had anyone questioned who he was, I know he pointed to the things he did. He even said in the book of John, like, hey, if you don't believe in me, then at least believe on the things that I've done. Like, believe the fact that you've seen all these crazy things happen. And I just wonder if that isn't what Christianity was meant to be from the beginning, where you and I could say to all of our friends that maybe haven't experienced God in this way, hey man, well look at what God did to you. Remember when your neck was messed up? Remember when this happened? Remember when this or that? And it's like, oh yeah, that's right, man. A Christian prayed for me. I got supernaturally healed. I didn't. This is not a. I went to the doctor, and the doctors performed surgery, and then something happened. It's anyway. That's a long. You
No,
got me excited about
and
where
in
I'm
terms of
excited. So thanks.
two things that made me think about listening to you. One was that old saying, God answers all prayers, and sometimes the answer is no. And the other is, yeah, in terms of Jesus and questioning, I mean, he was questioning God on the cross. You know, yeah. One of the most famous yeah. utterances of Jesus was you know, the end of that story. Still asking questions.
Right.
Know? There's certainly the idea that the Christian tradition is something that should be locked up and frozen in a particular snapshot and never questioned, I think, is, you know, it's the antithesis of what the whole tradition was about from the very, yeah. its very genesis, you know. But all this idea of supernatural experiences and occurrences is so fascinating. And I think the hardest part of who you are and what you represent probably for people to grasp, right,
sure.
or to wrestle with, because I'm sure you know even mainline Christians who are still very rationally minded in terms
yeah.
of their, you know, and they can sit and give you the scientific philosophical yeah. angle on their reason for the existence of God and for their belief in the Christian faith in particular, but then maybe still aren't willing to go that next step with you of
sure.
You know, that you of intercessory prayer, that you can ask God
yeah.
Hey, you know, turn this water into wine sort of thing and see it happen yeah. in front of you.
Yeah. And I would even take it one step further that we're, what I'm talking about and what I'm suggesting is moving beyond intercessory prayer, which is more of a petitioning God, you know, God, please do this, or I beseech you to perform this wonder upon my mother's, you know, cancerous thing or whatever. I don't know. I'm just thinking of some random thing. And I am getting back to the model in which Jesus taught, which was what you alluded to without, again, prophetically, without even knowing it, is, you know, commanding something to change. Mm. Jesus did not petition God except for right before he went to the cross. And the petition was, if there's any way out of this, will you please show up in that way? Because this is going to be the hardest thing I will ever have to do. And but when it came to people who were sick or hurting or had demonic stuff going on, there wasn't the ways in which Jesus spoke to people were extremely simple. Be healed, leave, you know, they were very short, very command focused, which that's where I think probably some of my more scientifically minded realist brothers and sisters in the faith that are like, well, that's, now we're getting a little crazy in our praying, because that's a risk. Because if you command something to change and it doesn't, then well, clearly you don't have faith, or clearly you're not doing what God wants you to do. You're not understanding his will or something like that. So I just love the idea of going back to the Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, and just looking at how did Jesus pray? And so when someone brought Jesus a problem or an issue, how did he deal with it? And it's totally changed the way that I pray for people and the way that I interact with people, especially when they're hurting and when they're sick and have issues going on.
Well, that's a perfect place to wrap up, as you brought us back to a reference to one of the very first questions I had. And brought it all back around.
Nice. Hey, that was my point.
I gotta have you on more and more and more, because there's so much more to get into and talk about.
Well, thanks, dude. Thank you for having me on here, and thank you for the kindness that you've shown me over the years. I really do value you and our friendship, and I love how this conversation feels as organic as if you and I were sipping coffee, right?
That's,
you know, next
idea.
To each other.
That's the highest compliment you could pay to this podcast, because that's exactly how I want all the conversations to feel. And okay. And I can say, as a testament and as taking a risk for myself, that will raise some eyebrows of friends and listeners. A lot of the things that you're talking about and the supernatural stuff, I've witnessed firsthand, and I've seen happen with you in your presence and in the presence of the Holy Spirit, or whatever you want to call it. And this is me as somebody who has said many times on this podcast that the place where I'm at in my own walk, in my own life, is finding beauty and certainty in the mystery, and finding certainty in the uncertainty and doubt, and places where you and I may diverge and then even sort of angle right back together. And that for all of that, I can definitively say I have seen a fruit of your prayer. Mm. in my own life. So I know yeah. I know somewhere in all of that, in the big mess of it, there's yeah. something about who you are and what you represent and what your book is about that's real. So
yeah, well, take thanks, that, man. Everybody. That's an honor, and same way, and it's. I love that you are giving people space to explore where they're at and not, I think a lot of one of the greatest problems that we've dealt with in faith of any kind is that if you start thinking outside this faith box, that then it's over for you. And that's obviously a really, really heavy fear-based place to live. And I don't know how anybody,
the house of cards. Well, if this changes, right. then the whole thing collapsed, you know, yeah. it's like,
yeah.
No, it doesn't have to be that way.
No.
Everything doesn't have to be a binary either or proposition. You know, it's all big mess of nuance, and that's the fun and exciting part of it.
Yeah. And we get to wrestle through it together. And so thanks for including me in the beautiful mess. That was a beautiful mistake. I thought I almost had another one, but I didn't.
So close. Well, I love you dearly, and I thank you so much you for too, coming bro. On here and for everything that you do and everything that you
Likewise.
Are. And I can't wait to have you back.
Yeah, thanks, bro. Love awesome. You too. See ya.
Chad Johnson. The book is 1,000 Risks. You can find out more about Chad and how to get a hold of this book at chadisliving.com. Now, I know every podcast that you listen to begs for reviews, but seriously, please leave us a 5-star rating and a nice review in the iTunes store, Stitcher, Google, wherever you consume your podcast. It really does help. The reason why everyone's always clobbering their listeners with this request is because the more reviews you get, the higher the visibility for your podcast, and the more people will discover it. If you like what we're doing with the No Price From God podcast, that's one very easy way that you can support. It takes such a short amount of time, and there's such great reward from it. So please, seriously, if you've got your phone in your hand right now, just do it right now. It takes a couple minutes, tops. You can now find No Price From God on Patheos, where we take deeper dives into some of the tangents and topics that are explored on No Price From God. You can also find No Price From God on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. You can find me on Twitter at Ryan Downey and on Instagram at Superhero HQ. No Price From God is part of the Pop Curse Podcast Network. And as always, you guys have been great, and I've been Ryan J. Downey.